gives me great pleasure to introduce Ralph W. from Los Angeles, our main speaker.
My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Annette for asking me to come out and being so diligent and following up. And I want to thank all the people who I had the pleasure and opportunity to have dinner with. And I want to wish all those who stood up and celebrated various lengths of recovery, I want to wish you happy birthday. Somebody was 37 today, I think, and we had some 30s and we had some teens, and oh man, I want to wish you all happy birthday. And then I don't want to disrespect you, those of you who celebrated. Don't want to disrespect you, those of who've been doing this considerably longer than me, but I really didn't come here to talk to you. Bob, Trisha, I came to talk to you. I came to talk to you. And I want to thank you, Lori, for that talk you gave and for recognizing and welcoming our new friends, the alcoholics tonight, because that's what we're here for. That's why we came here tonight. We came here, we were waiting on you. We know a couple of things about you. We know this has not been a good year for you. And a lot of people and a lot of speakers at this point would feel the need to be extremely encouraging, say it's going to be all right, and I want to let you know it ain't going to be all right. Not if I keep doing it the way I was doing it. Not if I keep trying to do it on my own. Not if I keep going the way I was going. Not if the things keep happening to me that keeps happening to me. Ain't going to be all right. But I got good news. There is help. That's the good news. The bad news, we're it. I believe in a couple of things. I like to talk about it every now and then. I believe in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in the 12 Steps of Recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous that introduced me to a power that gives me the power to say, no, thank you, I'm not drinking today. And I still believe in miracles. I want to talk about it. You know, something happened for most of us here. You know, not too long ago, not too far from here, you guys were being ravaged by the fires, nature's ravages, and can't stop it, can't do nothing about it. You know, I remember not too long ago in Florida, I think, you know, they had the, it was hurricane season and the water was, and the thing about when weather is coming, you can see it. The meteorologists can tell us about it. They can warn us. And the best we can do is evacuate. And it seemed to me I was living a life and it was just waves and waves and waves were just pounding me, watching my life. And something happened one night. And it seemed like just like that, the wave just stopped. It just stopped. I didn't make it happen. Nobody in here made it happen. And I started walking up under it. Walking under that deal we call grace. Can't explain it. Can't produce it. Can't direct it. But something happened to each and every person here. Walking up under that wave. So what happened, dude? What happened to you? In the 30s, there was a guy, somewhat like, guy like us, like most of us here. And he had a drinking problem. It was a severe drinking problem. And he was a man of means. And he did what people with money do. I don't know nothing about it, but I've heard about what people with money do, you know. He threw money at the problem. Threw money at the problem. Name was Roland Hazard. And back in about 1931, 32, Roland Hazard had a drinking problem. And he went across the ocean to see the preeminent psychiatrist of the day, Dr. Carl Jung. And he went and he saw Dr. Jung for about a year. And Jung did what it is the shrinks do, shrunk Roland real well, you know. Roland came away from him saying, I understand my, you know, the inner workings of my mind. I understand myself real well. I know I'm not going to drink now. I got this. I got it. And he came back to the States, and before he got off the boat, Roland was drunk. Roland was drunk. So Roland did what I would do if I had spent good money with somebody. He went back to see him. Dude, what happened? I understand you the preeminent guy. You're not a quack. I didn't think you were at any rate. And I came to see you. I spent good money with you. And you know, and I didn't even get off the boat. I didn't even make it back to the States. Drunk all over again. You need to tell me what happened. And Dr. Jung told Roland one thing. He said, Roland, he said, I tripped. I tripped. I'm sorry. You know, Roland's like, what? He said, I misdiagnosed your case. I misdiagnosed your case. See, you present like a lot of other things. You present like manic depressive. You present like schizophrenic. You present like bipolar. But you know what you got, Roland? You got the mind of a chronic alcoholic. That's what you are. And I've never seen a case like yours recover. I've tried a lot of methods. And the methods I've employed with you have been entirely unsuccessful. I've never seen it. And Roland said, hold up, Doc. Wait a minute. Dude, you the last place I had to go. Is there any hope for me? Felt like the gates of hell to cling on. And Dr. Jung said, well, Roland, check this out. Every now and then, here and there, I've heard what are called vital spiritual experiences that have happened to people. Like I ain't seen one myself. I've been trying to produce that in you. Dr. Silkworth said that later on in the doctor's opinion. He talked about, I know what you need, Ralph. You need some act right, get right. I've been trying to put some act right, get right in you, but I ain't been able to do it. I don't know nobody been able to do it. But if you know, and so he said, I know this vital spiritual experiences, they seem to be in the nature of phenomena. I don't know how to produce, I don't know what to tell you. If you're a member of a church, if you're a member of any religious body, I suggest you go back there and maybe, just maybe, you'll get struck by lightning. And Roland went back to the Oxford groups of the day that he was a member of, and he got struck by lightning. Something happened in the Oxford group. And through that gentleman, a little bit later on, you know, Roland Hazard, this spiritual experience deal, through a series of other events, dot connecting dots, Roland Hazard, through Bill Wilson, through Dr. Bosman, something happened that got transmitted to us and what it is that we're able to do. So what happens, this miracle business anyway, this every now and then business anyway? When Roland Hazard left Dr. Carl Jung, it was every now and then, here and there, we see the doctor had heard about. So what happens that there's a room full of folk tonight that couldn't put it down, and all of a sudden, something happened that the same things that used to dominate these people, these same people that if you turn your back on them, somebody would go up in your pocket. What happened that these same people are now greeting you at the door? What happened that these same people are not happy? What happened that these same people are now giving you their phone? What happened to these people? And why is it so many of them if this miracle deal only happens every now and then? And what Bill Wilson describes it as, he calls it a wholesale miracle when it's this many of us. And I'm going to share with you this deal of ours that allows us to replicate that spiritual experience and does it so well. And I didn't know that's what I was walking in. I didn't know that's what I was walking into when I walked in some years ago. You know, we're a storytelling society. And a lot of times you'll hear our members, especially to get into recovery, and they'll say something. You'll probably keep going to meetings, keep going to meetings, keep going to meetings, Bob. And you'll hear people, and they'll be, sometimes you'll hear them when they really get into recovery. They'll say, I don't want to share a long drunk a log. I just want to share about recovery. Everybody knows how to drink. That's not why we tell our stories. We don't tell our stories to try as a primer on how to drink. And everybody don't know how to drink. We wouldn't be up in here. We ain't been too successful at drinking. you know, that ain't why we tell our stories. If you go to enough meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, Trish, and you keep going, and if you've been going, I don't know, you know, we got two categories of newcomers most of the time. We got new newcomers and we got used newcomers. Most of the time these days, we get used newcomers. So it ain't new, you know, and I've been there before, you know, and sometimes the inclination is to say, I've tried Alcoholics and I know it don't work. I've tried. It reminds me of a guy that has a gym membership. I have a gym membership and I go to the gym and I go to the gym religiously. I go to the gym righteously. I know everybody's name in the gym. I stand at the door. I hand out the towels. Here, baby. Here's your towel. Or here's a towel. You know, hey, high five. And, you know, I see you down there on the bench, Robert. Yeah, man. One more, Rob. One more. I'm looking at you. And then in about 30 days, I'm getting pissed off because Robert is walking out and his gut is shrinking and I'm still looking the same. You know, and I'm like, damn. And in 90 days, all you guys are walking and you fit and you tone. And I'm like, and I leave the gym and I talk about the gym don't work because I've been coming to the gym. I know everybody's name at the gym. I've been handing out towels at the gym. I ain't picked up a weight. I ain't laid on a bench. I ain't done nothing they do at the gym. But I visited the gym. And then I leave the gym and I say, the gym don't work. You know, and so that's that deal. So what happens in this thing of ours? So this storytelling society I was talking about, the reason we tell our stories, if you go to enough meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll get a lot of information. You know, we are great at that. And I need a lot of information. This stuff, I don't know about this thing. I don't know, I don't even know how grave this deal is that I'm dealing with at first. And I don't even know what it looked like. I just think the alcoholic is the guy in the trench coat waiting on the LIQ to open at 6 in the morning. It's a lot of information I need, a lot of stuff to learn. But that's not the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not really what binds and holds us and keeps us coming back in Alcoholics Anonymous. Most of us come back in Alcoholics Anonymous not for the information. We come back for the transformation. Yes. It's transformational things that take place in this room. I love it. That's why I love it. I see it the most in the ladies. I see it the most in our women. You know, somebody would get up here. Lori was getting up here, looked like a housewife, not look like a soccer mom. I'm like, what the hell is she doing up in here with us? By the time you leave this podium, we'd be like, ooh, baby, don't you leave us. You know, I love that. I love that in you guys. I love transformational things that take place. And you can't appreciate where I am today if you don't know where I come from. So we talk about where we come from. And where I come from is South Central Los Angeles. I grew up in the heart of Watts. I'm one of six boys. We stayed in a little two-bedroom apartment. Moms and pops in one room, six boys and three bunk beds in the other room. Earliest memory of my old man was he was an alcoholic and I didn't want to be like him. My father wasn't abusive and he wasn't violent. He was an absentee drunk. Pops had left the house. My mom put him out after I was about 9 or 10 years old, and she proceeded to raise these six boys by herself. Now, I didn't appreciate the upbringing I had. This is a special season for me. I've always loved the Christmas season. It's always been important to me. I didn't know anything about dysfunctional family till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's true that that if you listen to the outlines of my life, it would sound like I had good reasons for drinking, but I wouldn't have changed the way I grew up for nothing in the world. I had a hell of a mom, and she raised these six boys, and we didn't have a lot. You know, when you're grown, you get something called perspective, and perspective works like this. You got a mom that raised six boys by herself, and my mom was on welfare back in the 60s, and she refused to settle for a lot. She put herself back through high school. She put herself through college. She worked two jobs. She took in clothes that she washed and ironed for other folk, and when you look back on your life and you say, damn, I had a hell of a mom. Look how she sacrificed to raise her kids. But when you're a kid about 9 or 10 years old, and you're coming home from school on a Wednesday afternoon with a couple of partners, and you hit the front door, and mom's is in the living room with an ironing board up and a rag on her head, you don't feel proud. You feel ashamed and embarrassed, and you stop bringing partners home from school. And if your name is Ralph, you start living in the prison I've lived in much of my life. And that's the prison of what I think you think about me. Don't know what you think about me, trapped in what I think you think about me. And I will do whatever it takes to shape and form and mold your opinion of Ralph. I'll wine you, I'll dine you, I'll woo you, I'll con you, I'll bully you, I'll manipulate you, I'll buy you. Please like me. Now, I don't particularly have to like your ass, but please like me. So I'm growing up like that, and new friends, if you go to enough meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll hear some common themes. And one of the common themes that you hear from most of our members is, I never felt like I fit in. And that's not a part of my story. I'm a little guy, I like a lot of attention. I've never been interested in fitting in. I've always wanted to stand out. And as a result of that, I achieved and I accomplished a couple of things coming up in life. Every one of you had me in your classroom. I was usually class president, student body president, straight A student, teacher's pet, played ball, made all-stars. On the outside, I should have been okay. On the inside, I've always felt like if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. Yeah, I was teacher's pet. Yeah, I was straight A student. Would have traded it all in if I could have been cool. I just could have been cool, because in my neighborhood, it was a whole lot more currency placed on cool than on smart, because the cats who were cool, there's some cool cats in there right now. They were the ones in the bathroom, smoking cigarettes, shooting dice, taking quarters from guys like me that brought extra quarters with them. And you knew how to talk to girls. Girls were a mystery to me. Fellas, I don't know why it was. You guys always had a handle on this manhood thing that I just didn't know. 13 years old, cats would be talking about throwing down with girls already. I didn't know you were lying, but I'd be thinking to myself, how come I don't know? You know, it took me a while to get comfortable telling my story in Alcoholics Anonymous. First place I ever landed where folk try to out-bottom each other, right? And I wanted a penitentiary story without visiting the pen to get it. And, you know, my story's my story. I'm not willing to go get another one. You know, I'm a shy guy, I'm square, I'm scared of girls, I ain't touched nothing. I'm 16 years old. That's late in Alcoholics Anonymous. 16, and I get a girlfriend at 16. Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 don't mean the same thing it means for some of you cats. Ralph with a girlfriend at 16 simply means this. Ran with a crew of dudes, went with the same group of girls. One of my boys broke up with this girl, waited a little time to pass, told my other boy I want to go with her. He went and asked her, came back and told me. She said, yeah, now I got a girlfriend. Right? I'd had other girlfriends before, but this one actually knew she was my girlfriend. I don't know what to do with girls, but this particular night I'm in the back seat of a car on a double day. Older partner of mine, him and his girl in the front seat. He's driving. Plastic, me and my girl in the back. Plastic cup of rum and coke come to the back seat this particular night. Drink it down real warm. Rush back to the top of my brain. All of a sudden, Ralph's hands started doing things they had never done. Mouth started saying things it had never said. I'd arrived. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Gave me the courage to do and to be and to say things I wouldn't do, be and say without it. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous describes me in lots of places. We have a chapter in the front, new friends, called The Doctor's Opinion. Line in the doctor's opinion jumped out at me first time I read it. Men and women like me drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. I'm not overnight alcoholic. I understand we talk about this disease being progressive in nature because that's how it showed up in my experience. That first night I drank, I didn't get pissy drunk. I didn't throw up all over myself. I didn't make a fool out of myself. I got a warm, tipsy feeling. I kissed and licked and sucked on my girl in some places I had never done before. And that's how my drinking stayed. I would drink to go out on the weekends and party. Graduated from high school in 71, graduated to higher education in every sense of the word. 71, I'm still drinking the night of the weekend to go party. By the end of 71, I'm drinking not only the night of the weekend, but I'm drinking during the day to get ready for the party that night. By 1972, I'm drinking not only on the weekend, but I'm drinking during the week after class, and I've added some non-addictive marijuana to the mix. By the end of 72, I'm drinking and I'm smoking herb and I'm selling herb. By 1973, I'm drinking, I'm smoking herb, I'm selling herb, I'm doing other drugs, I'm doing it on a daily basis, and you couldn't have told me it was anything wrong with the way I was living. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about at a certain point in my drinking career, I won't be able to tell the truth from the false, and the way that that worked for me is this. Isn't the way that I'm doing it, isn't that the way everybody does it? Why would you be young, with a bright future, with a little bit of money, then chasing women and getting loaded, come with the territory? In those days, man, if you came over to my house and I couldn't offer you something to drink or something to smoke, I wasn't being a good host. And if I went over your house and you didn't do the same for me, not only weren't you being a good host, wasn't coming over your house no more. For what? You have nothing to talk about. You know, no disrespect to our young friends. I don't mean new friends, young friends. I'm glad I grew up in the era I grew up. I'm glad I grew up in the time I grew up. Back in the late 60s and the 70s, you would go to a concert, you didn't even have to know your neighbor, you just pass and stuff. In 2018, you got to practice safe sex, you got deadly sexually transmitted disease. Man, back in those days, even though the 70s was a turbulent time in this country, in some ways it seemed like a much simpler time. And back in those days, I'd go to a club, I'd have a one-question interview for a girl. You get high? If not, next. I don't want to know your last name. I don't need to know your sign. I don't need to know none of the rest of that. Let's get to the basis of this relationship. Are you getting down like I'm getting down? And that's just the way it was, you know. I came around the program. I'm one of the used newcomers, too. I came around the program four times before I came to stay. And in my in and out and in and out, I learned there are some thin lines in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the thinnest lines that makes most of the difference, there's a thin line between comparing and identifying. In my early efforts at doing this deal, I would always compare and I'd never identify. And I couldn't find myself in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't find myself in any of you guys' stories. I would read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, I read Bill's story. First thing I say when I read Bill's story, Bill is an older white guy. We ain't got that in common. Bill was a veteran of foreign wars, Vietnam era draft dodger. Bill was a Wall Street stockbroker. Check out the way I handle money. If you read Bill's story, he had it near. There had been no real infidelity. Miss me on that one too. You know, so I would always find all the differences. I do the same thing when you guys got up here and shared. And when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to stay, somebody taught me how to read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, Ralph, the same way that you read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous is the same way that you listen to our members share at the meetings. When you read the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous and when you listen to our members share their experience, strength, and hope, ask yourself three or four questions. Ask yourself, did I drink like he drank? Did I think like he thought? Did I feel like he felt? Or did I do what he did? And when I read Bill's story in the light of those questions, I found my story. I'm at this major university, and just like Bill, the drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. Just like him, drinks started taking a more important and exhilarating part in my life. Bill in his story said something strange. He said, out of this alloy of drink and speculation, out of this combination of his thinking and his drinking, he would later forge a weapon that would turn on him like a boomerang and all but cut him to ribbons. I don't talk like that. Where I come from, old folk had a shortcut version. They used to say, trouble always starts out like fun. And you couldn't have told me when I was up in the dorms drinking that Yago, drinking that Spinata, drinking that Tyrolia, drinking that Annie Green Springs, drinking that Boone's Farm, drinking that Southern Comfort, drinking that. You couldn't have told me alcohol was going to have its way with me. But it did what it is that it does, and I stumbled up out of that school, and I started working as a counselor for LA City Schools, and although I had the kind of job that should have allowed me to acquire what normal people acquired, I never did that. Snapshot of Ralph's life, this is when alcohol was working. I'd buy a car, I'd make exactly three car payments, then come find it. Come find it. First time I had a car repossessed, I had the nerve to call LAPD. 9 months behind on the note, right? Didn't even trip next time. Kind of brother never had a problem balancing a bank book. Payday, I got money. 2 days later, broke. Zero. No problem balancing my bank book. Stayed in the crib from 1976 to 1979 without paying rent. Couple of baffling features about the disease I suffer from, one of them is this. I can't see my relationship with alcohol until I'm free of it. I can't see what it's doing to me when I'm in the mix. So some of the things that are crystal clear to me now, looking back in the rearview mirror of experience, were not at all clear to me when I was going through them. One fact stands out real clear to me about the days I thought alcohol was working. I used to go to work for 2 weeks to live for 2 days. That's it, that's all. Can't tell you the day or the time and hour, can't tell you where I was or what I was doing when alcohol ceased to be a luxury for me. I can tell you that it did happen. You know what I don't like about the invisible line? Yeah, it's invisible. It ain't nothing to say. If you take this next one, you enter in the region from which there's no return to human. Matter of fact, by the time you realize it's a line, it's you way over here in the line. Who put that line back there? You know, cold thing about the disease I suffer from is this. By the time I realize I have a problem and need to do something about it, already too late for me to do something about it. Damn. Anybody else in here play the regret game in Alcoholics Anonymous? A lot of head. Now, the regret game in Alcoholics Anonymous goes something like this. If I only knew then, What I know now, yeah, right. Remind me of a story I like to tell about a little boy named Johnny. Johnny had a habit his father frowned on. Johnny used to like to play with himself. Father goes to work one day, comes home early. Little Johnny's bedroom door is closed. Father opens the door without knocking. Sure enough, little Johnny's in the bedroom masturbating. Father says, son, I thought I told you if you keep doing that, you'll go blind. Little Johnny stopped and looked at his dad and said, well, daddy, can I just do it till I need glasses? You know what I mean? I like that story because that story reminds me of me in the life. I see you going down, you going down, you going down. I'm just going to do it till I need glass. Book talks about seeking the Lord companion. Wasn't long before I became the Lord companion, and we ain't got enough time. Got married on a Saturday afternoon in April of 1980. Had a bachelor party the night before my wedding. None of the guys at the bachelor party are getting married the next day. All of them have sense enough to go home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm still at my bachelor till 7:30 in the morning, me and my brothers. Take me home, pour me in bed at 7:30, get me up at 10 o'clock for my 1 o'clock wedding. I'm tore up. I'm supposed to say my own vows at this wedding, and I show up, and apparently the stagger was so severe that my then wife-to-be took one look at me stumbling. She looked at the preacher. Okay, scratch the own vows, say the regular on him. My lines are now cut to two words. We get into the ceremony, I get ready to say, I sat there and threw up all over. Oh. Passed out. Have not taken a wedding picture to this day. Pitiful. An incomprehensible demoralization. When I first hit the rooms, although the words you guys use in the room were not unfamiliar to me, the way you guys use them is not the way I use them in my everyday walk around vocabulary. You guys were talking about stuff like this psychic change and this phenomena of craving and this allergy of the body. And the way you guys use all those terms, I needed some help with. But the first time I heard pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, didn't need no help with that one. Folk like us don't need a dictionary for pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I lived pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization up close and personal, and I lived it over and over and over again. See, I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my living room couch, wife coming out the bathroom real fast. Go to the dining room table, pulling her pants up. She go to the dining room table, pick her purse up off the table, clutch it real close as she went back to the bathroom. And I feel this tall because nobody was in the house but me and her. It got like that in my house. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember coming home, sticking my key in the door. Wife and two-year-old daughter sitting here, they crying. I look over here and homeboy sitting in my seat and he's got a gun pointed right in my stomach talking about I want my money right now. Fellas, let me holler at you guys for just a minute. I don't know about the rest of you, but I always had a lot of fears and a lot of doubts about, do I have what it takes to be a father? Do I have what it takes to be a husband? Because if you're in the life, your track record already gives you the answer, right? Because what's the father's role and what's the husband's role? To protect and to provide, and it's a cold-blooded feeling, fellas. Laying in bed with a woman night after night after night after night. Knowing not only aren't you protected, knowing not only aren't you providing, you're the one bringing the wolf to the door. See, I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Remember sitting on my back porch, two-year-old daughter coming outside, pulling in my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. I remember stopping, giving her a little grin. Don't worry, baby. Daddy's going to put some dollar bills in here for this change. And I wasn't ready to be stealing from my daughter, and I wasn't ready to be stealing from my wife. I was an alcoholic with no tools of recovery. Did what it took to get what I needed to get. Share with you that my disease is progressive in nature, and in my experience, it's progressive in a couple of areas. Share one area already. Takes more than it used to take in order for me to get the same effect. But my disease is progressive in another area, my behavior. My behavior gets progressively worse. I'm willing to do more readily, chase it. First time I hit my wife's purse, if you would hook me up to a poly, I would have passed when I told you I'm not stealing this $40. I'm gonna take this money and replace it before she knows it's missing. Minute. There's a line in the book that describes me to a T. We don't know why, but the alcoholic could be unable to recall with sufficient force pain, suffering, humiliation weeks, even days ago. 2 weeks after I said I'm going to replace the money before she knows it's missing, I'm out doing what it is that I do. spent up all my money, came back looking for it. That thought of replacing it didn't even come to mind. Got replaced with a new thought. Last time I took $40 and she moved the purse when I came back looking. This time I'll take all the money out the purse. That I don't spend up, I'll sneak it back in the purse. Off and running to hitting it on a regular. Did it one too many times, came home one morning, screen door was locked with a note on it. Rest of your stuff is at your mama's house. Suitcase on the porch, I put out my house, I'm now my dad. Over the course of the next year, my five brothers got put out of their respective homes. All of us ended up at my mom's house and we damn near killed her. When I got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house, my ex-wife thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man she married. She would bring my daughter over on Saturday so we could keep a father-daughter relationship. And I wanted to be a father to my little girl with everything in me. I really, really, really did. I wanted to take her to Disneyland and I wanted to take her to Magic Mountain. I wanted to take her to a movie on a Saturday afternoon. I wanted to walk up the street with her little hand in my big hand, take her to the store and buy her some ice cream. I wanted to sit her in my lap and read stories to her. I wanted to tuck her in bed at night and get a good night kiss. I wanted to get the look from my little girl that I've seen men in the fellowship get, to look like this is my daddy and this is my hero. And the best I could do on those Saturdays was 30 minutes. 30 minutes. Tell my mom something like I'm going to the store to buy Rain some ice cream. I disappeared. Sneak back on Sunday when her mom was coming to get her. Still remember some of them long Sunday nights, sticking my head around the side of my mom's house, tears flowing. And through the tears, I see those two heads in the car and those headlights backing out. And I think to myself, there goes my life, backing out this driveway. And I've heard a lot of people share they were scared of dying out there, and that's not my story. Never scared of dying, scared I was gonna keep waking up to the same old thing. Monday the same as Tuesday, the same as Sunday, the same as Christmas, over and over and over again. And I'm so glad God don't make misery comfortable. And on October the 11th, 1986, I got miserable enough. I got tired enough. I got directed to my fourth program of recovery. I went to the Harbor Light Center on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. That October in 86, I was in a real bad way. I was in a real dark place. I thought I'd never be able to forgive myself for the things I had done and what I had become. First weekend in the light, they brought a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous into the facility and they took us to that meeting. And a gentleman was standing up in front of the group that night, somewhat like I am tonight. And he was sharing about taking from the job, and he was sharing about taking from the family. And I remember looking at him and thinking to myself, yeah, you're sharing about doing scandalous things, but you look scandalous. You should have been doing that. I'm different. Y'all ain't gonna hear my business. And the speaker seemed like he knew I was in the room. He dropped something on me like this. He said, if you're sitting in this room right now, you are not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. And you have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. And you don't have to drink and you don't have to use no matter what, provided you are willing to fulfill some conditions. That speaker that night caught my attention. He went on to say, this is the only club you can be a member of, where the worse off you are when you get here, better off your chances of staying. And I got the message of hope. And I got with you. You know, they say there are no bad speakers at Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's probably true. It's a couple of bad listeners. I'm one of them, you know. I think there are two kinds of speakers to me. Head speakers, figure outers, and I like head. I like head speakers. I like figuring stuff out. I'm that kind of guy, you know, so that kind of appealed to me, you know, but, and then they had what I like to think of as heart speakers. My first home group in 9604 South Figueroa, we had a brother named Brother there. And Brother used to say, when heart speaks, heart hears. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we taught the language of the heart. And the reason I say that is because my story's my story, you know? And so usually I kind of know what I'm gonna say because it ain't gonna change. But tonight I'm like, I wonder what we gonna hear next. Because I don't know. There's an energy. When I was a kid, I used to wonder, why do Major League Baseball players find it so easy to hit fastballs? Because as a kid, I never lost my fear of the ball. That's why I didn't go but a certain level. Baseball was my game, too. And I couldn't understand that, you know. But I didn't understand there's something about the batter not having supplied all the energy. It's the same thing sometimes when you're talking. You guys are sitting up here and you think it's just a guy up here that's talking, but it's interactive and it's some energy that goes on in the room sometimes, you know. And as I was talking, sometimes it feels like a story about somebody else, and every now and then it gets real, you know. And I want to talk about what I found, especially right now. This is, we're coming on my favorite time of the year. I don't know what we're going to talk about now. Let's just see. You know, we're talking about my favorite time of the year, Christmas. I was in the Harbor Light in 1986 in October. And I was coming up on 90 days about this time of the year. And I was so trifled, I didn't even know I could have been drawing disability that last year I was out there. And I had been working in management in a major utility company. And I got fired from that job in 1985. And from 1985 to 1986, I walked the aimless walk. I was never homeless because my mom never put us out, but I walked the aimless walk, you know. And I was so trapped, I didn't even know I could get disability. I went to Harbor Light, I started getting disability, and they would put the money on the books. So they had money on the books for me, so when I left the facility. So in December of 1986, I'm coming up on 90 days, and Christmas is coming. And I go in there and I ask for some money so I could buy my little girl a Christmas present. Rain was 2.5. And I walked from downtown Los Angeles, where the Harbor Light was, and they have little stores downtown, a step above swap meets, you know. And I bought a little gray jacket, a little pink jacket with a gray fur collar. In my mind's eye, you know, I'm like, it looked like a little ratty jacket. But when I gave it to my girl, that Christmas coming up on 90 days, I don't know why I said this. It looked like a mink stole. Something was different. I had tried this for something was different. I was 33 years old and I was tired of losing. Something was different. I'm not tonight's speaker because I'm the one that's trying to scare you into recovery. That's not my message. I'm not the one that's going to be sharing with you if you go back out there still kicking. You know, people used to look at me, you know, the message of fear, that ain't the message that'll hold a guy like me. You know, people used to look at me and what I used to think of as my heyday and be like, damn, Ralph, ain't you scared of overdose? I'd be like, scared of overdose? I'm scared of the deadly underdose. You better put some more up on here. So the message of fear ain't never scared me. Book talks about a message that's got to have depth and it's got to have weight. The message tonight speaker brings to you that's got the most depth and the most weight. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had given up on life. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old did not know where his little girl was enrolled in school and didn't know where his family was living. You're looking at a guy who at 33 years old had not answered anybody's 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock wake up call to go to work. And so long, I no longer thought I was employable. You're looking at a guy who came from a major university in this country and my job at the end was taking the trash out for a 21-year-old. I was sleeping in the back of my mother's garage. I was eating lemons off a neighbor's lemon tree for breakfast. And the men and women in this fellowship met me in that condition, and you loved me and you nursed me back to health. I started going to meetings. I started going to meetings. I started catching the bus to meetings. Didn't have a car. Didn't have a driver's license yet. I got a license when I was in the Harbor Light Center. I came to you guys, man, toe up. And I started going to meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a home group at night, 9604 South Figueroa, and I had a home group in the daytime, the old Crenshaw Lotto Club. And I catch the bus, and you guys would say, if you make it to the meeting, we'll get you home. And I started doing the deal, and I started going to meetings, and I started going to meetings, and I started going to meetings, and something started happening. You know, and if you go to enough meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll hear some common themes. And one of the common themes that I heard in my home group all the time, they were talking about that book and they were talking about recovery. I've always been a person that what I get into, I'm all the way in it. You know, I'm an all-in kind of guy. That's just the way I roll, you know. I'm not a sideline kind of guy. I'm all in. I'm all in. You know, don't I ain't never been one of those kind of guys, you know. So then I got the kind of sponsor that talks about that. We got a third tradition in Alcoholics Anonymous. That third tradition is the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. The minute I have a desire to stop drinking, I'm on the team. Can't nobody put me off the team. Can't nobody escort me out. You ain't got to try out. You ain't got to audition. In fact, you already have done the audition and then the trying out. The minute I say it, I'm on the team. That's a wonderful thing. That's a broad umbrella. That's a real broad thing. But check this out. Everybody that's on the team ain't in the game. Put me in the game. Put me in the goddamn game. Put me in the game. Now, I'm not knocking the people to come around. We need fans. We need spectators. We even need haters. We even need commentators on the game that think of, but put me in the goddamn game. I ain't never been one that's a sideline guy. I just have not been one. Fellas, I can't even go to strip clubs because I don't like looking. Put me in. Put me in. Put me in. Well, what the hell, Mr. Speaker? What is this put me in the game thing you're talking about? What does that look like and what does it mean for real? You know, as a result of picking up this simple kit of spiritual tools, as a result of applying these principles in my life, I don't come to the gym and get up top. No, put me in. Put me in. On with about 18 months, me and my brother, we were going to, we were at a meeting of alcoholics, and it was a marathon like you guys advertised. And a group was presenting at that marathon, and they were presenting the big book in a way I had never seen and never heard. And I got interested in it, because what I get in, I like to be in. Why be in a 12-step program and not know nothing about the 12 steps? We approached a couple of members of that group, and we said, would you take us through the book the way you did? And in November of 1987, about 12 of us sat around my mother's dining room table, and we started going through that book page by page, line by line. You know, and we didn't know. We did it one time, and we liked it, and some people heard about it, and they said, damn, we'd like to do that. And we said, okay, open my mother's door up again. We did another session. We said, okay, and we did it, and we did it, and we did it, and we did it, and we did it. And from November of 1987, we've been going at it, the Never Too Early Big Book Workshop. I got to leave here, so, you know, I got to get home because my workshop will be meeting tomorrow morning, you know, and we've been going over 30 years. And we started with 12, and that's about 250 to 300 people. Put me in the goddamn game. You know, I didn't expect that and didn't talk. And as a result of that, as a result of getting on my knees with some people and saying, God, I offer myself to you. Do something with me. He's done something with me. He's done something with me. He's done something with my life. As I was sharing that story about that two-year-old daughter whose piggy bank I was going in, my brother is here, my sister's here today, and my daughter, and it's a big sacrifice. But and we had the road. I don't do, you know, I don't do over 2 hours driving on the road. I'm an old man. I don't like it. I don't do it. But you can't tell me. I can't say no. Not where I come from. Put me in the goddamn game. And I'm so grateful, Reggie and Carol. And they said, let's roll. And we rolled out of here. And today, that two-year-old daughter whose piggy bank I was going in, she's having a baby shower today. She's getting ready to give me my second biological grandson. If I had known the grands were so cool, I'd have had them first. You know what I'm saying? I was going in the piggy bank. She's a practicing attorney in the state of California. She don't even know that guy. She was 2.5 years old when I got to you. 5 years ago, we walked down the aisle. She was taking the hand of a young man who came to me and asked for a hand. She was on my arm as we were walking down the aisle. The music was playing. She was talking and she was shaking. She said, Dad, this is the happiest day of my life. I'm sad about one thing. I said, what's that, baby? She said, this is the last day I'll ever be Rain White, but I'll always be Daddy's girl. Put me in the goddamn game. I got a 23-year-old daughter at home that's never seen her daddy loaded, and one day at a time, she never will. Last May, about 15 of us rolled out to Boston, and we hollering and making a fool out of ourselves. My daughter was graduating from Boston University, right? And when she came out of her sophomore year, she moved out of the dorms as a freshman. And so rolled out, I flew to Boston. Me and my brother went down there to move her into her first crib. And she had two roommates, and all the parents were moving her in. Tris, I want you to have your own moment. It's plenty of, everybody in here can tell you about those grace moments. We used to call them coincidence, but folk in here know grace when it comes calling. You know, and I had to step away, you know. We were moving the kids and I had to go step in the bathroom. I'm crying, because it hit me. This is what dads do. They don't go in the piggy bank. They move their first little girl into their first crib. Put me in the gang. I don't have a way to prove it. I don't have scientific evidence for it. When my brother Reggie's here, he'll in 1985, my mom had a nervous breakdown. I don't know if she was going to make it. And in 1986 and 87, about four of us got sent to you guys. And my mom is still here. She's 88 years old. You can't tell me. You don't know what you're in here for, Bob. You don't know. Most of us don't know what we're here for. We think we see what's going on in here. We think we know what's going on in here right now. But every time I go to a meeting, I'm not at a meeting by myself. Do you know how many lives get changed because of the way we live in right now? Do you know how many little girls and little boys will see Christmas this year? You know how many grandkids have grandparents that sit up and take care of them when the parents, do you know what happens up in here? It's more than just me. If you look real close, I didn't come for the ripples, but I stay with for the ripples. Because what you see, this room has got way more folk in here than is in it right now. If you look real close, you see an 88-year-old lady right here. You see a 4-year-old little boy. You see a 23-year-old young lady. You see a 35. If I look real close, I see mama. I see the kids in there. I see them. Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, I get to participate in some little boy or some little girl getting ready to have mama come back. Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, we doing it right now. I get to participate in some family getting ready to have daddy come home. Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, I get to participate in some man or some woman getting ready to have a hell of a mate in their life. Every time I go to a meeting, me and you, I get to participate in some employer that I don't know and could care less about getting ready to have a hell of an employee in the workplace. Every time I go to a meeting, who wouldn't want to be part of a fellowship like that? I've always wanted to do something significant. I've always wanted to do something important. I can think of nothing more significant or more important than being a participating member of the life-saving, life-changing experience that is Alcoholics Anonymous. You'll never hear Ralph White say, I don't know why I'm sober. I know exactly why I'm sober. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, my gift to God. My name is Ralph White. I am an alcoholic.
Wow. Let's give Ralph one more applause.